To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
All right, you heard the song. It says, I'm Don, and with me is a man comfortable with mysteries, for he is a believer deep down.
Yes, I am, Al. I am. I saw her face.
Now, yeah, I'm a believer. And that's when you became a believer.
That's right. Anyway, and the monkeys.
All right, we came, and Al has got something on the table that I love immensely.
What, this?
Yes.
Want to talk about that? Okay, well, did you read this book like
no,
a long time ago?
No, I was kind of hoping you let me, though.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's an old issue of Alter Ego. I guess it's from number 63. Wow, December 2006. Is that one? I guess that's when Alex Toth passed away, around 2006, I guess. Right, or was it earlier than that? Because it's an issue called Remembering Alex Toth. Industry tributes, never seen interview, unseen. I forgot when he passed away, but
he lives in our lives. That year, somebody I love passed away, and so I'm not really sure. I guess he did.
But anyway, so I'm going through some books, and I find that, and I'm going like, wow, I haven't read this in a while, or maybe I didn't read the whole thing. So I started going through it. You know, typical, pretty good. A lot of cool interviews with Toth. You know, it's why you. The more I learn about the guy, the more I'm kind of like, wow, he was really like a, you know, tough nut to crack or whatever, but he was an amazing, you know, illustrator, artist, you know, genius dude or whatever, yeah. You know what I mean? But there's some really cool interviews. There was one in particular that it was with Joe Kubert. And, you know, Joe Kubert loved Toth, the artist, but one time he really wanted to do like a Enemy Ace story. So he got Robert Kaniger to write one for him, and Kurt Kubert was the editor. And when he got it back, of course, Toth rewrote it, redrew it or whatever, and like Kubert kind of got like PO'd because Kubert goes, look, I understand it's Toth and all that, but since I'm the editor of the book, if something happens to the book, I'm the one who takes the blame for it. You know, I'm the one that takes the hit for it. So I got, and I respect Robert Kaniger's script enough to, like, you know, to respect it. And I guess he sent it back to Toth, and, you know, he didn't get paid for it or something like that, you know. And then I think Jim Amish or whoever the interviewer was, did he ever work with him again? He goes, no, but apparently he did work with him again. There were some other issues or whatever, but it's like stuff like that where you're like, wow, you know, these guys were really like, you know, Toth was really like, he was just give him a script and he'll redo it, which to me it's like, I think it would be an improvement in a lot of cases. You know, maybe not Robert Kaniger, but some other, you know, I mean, it's like you get the, you write a script and you get a privilege of Alex Toth drawing it for you. To me, that's like, you know, you're never going to get that again, maybe in your life. So you might as well enjoy it for what it is, you know. And we were talking earlier about Harvey Kurtzman and Toth, like the book Burma Sky, was it Burma Sky or whatever?
I think that's it.
Yeah, because we were talking about how, like, Harvey Kurtzman was his war books for EC. Kurtzman's was like was very meticulous in the layouts, and you got to stick to what he drew, and you got to and of course Toth like variated from it completely, but Kurtzman let it go because it was so beautiful.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's the thing. What Al and I were talking about was it was an old episode where we talked about the Harvey Kurtzman EC war books. Where when I say this, they were great. But when you're reading the whole collection of them, even though the books are good, it's the same beats, it's the same timing. Harvey Kurtzman was really tight. He laid them out, and you weren't supposed to veer from it. And after a while, it's just like hearing a band that just plays the same thing with slight variations every once in a while. And I got really tired of it. And then when when that one came up, it was something. And then I read that Harvey Kurtzman was upset because Alex Toth just kind of veered away from it completely. But it's what Al said, that they let it go because it was so nicely done. But I don't think he really used Alex Toth too much after
that. No, he didn't. He did a few stories, but not that many. Maybe it's because Toth was doing other things. I don't know, but...
See, I didn't know Alex Toth was
Toth did die in 2006.
Okay. I didn't know he was so volatile.
Yeah, me neither.
Because I only knew his work, but I would read about him. The first time I heard him talk was Gil Kane in 1982 in Dallas, Texas. And he was telling the history of comics.
Probably they didn't get along either, Kane and Toth.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny. Gil Kane was like this gentleman. I mean, you know, he wore a suit. He spoke like he was a news commentator. He was an elder statesman of comics and quite well. One thing I liked is when he would do sketches for people. You know, Britt got a Nick Fury sketch from him. He collected them. And Gil Kane drew it. He spoke to Britt. And when he finished, he shook Britt's hand. I don't know. He was just, you know, he was a classic. And when he spoke to us, he spoke lovingly, you know, about the comic industry. And he was talking about excitement. And he was teaching with Bernd Hogarth and Harvey Kurtzman a master's class on comics. He was trying to elevate it and teach people, you know. And one thing he kept talking about was the French artist. And his Mobius he was just kind of in awe of. But he was telling a history about Gaines and how Gaines basically created the American comic book. He didn't say that, but, you know, he was talking about the history of that. And then he said he was talking about the contemporaries, you know, Joe Kubert and Alex Toth. But he kept going back to Alex Toth. He said, I think Alex had it more than any of us. Like, he had a vision and a plan, and he surpassed what any of them could do, even at that early age. And the way it sounded, it was like they were best of friends. And in the Comics Journal, I was reading, and, you know, Gary Groth interviewed Gil Kane. And I was kind of surprised. This is before he passed away, how bitter he was.
Mm.
I was really surprised because, you know, from 82, all that upbeat he had. But he was really bitter. And he talked about Alex Toth. Again, he talked about him the same way. But he said what hurt Alex was... He never really teamed up with any writer. It's just he just couldn't get along with anybody. Well, but when he said that, it wasn't like it was a mean-spirited, backstabbing
thing. No, it was just that's the way he was, you know.
And then I didn't get the next issue, but Britt said that Alex Toth just wrote this scathing fire and, you know, venom letter back to him about how dare he say this. And I'm like, man, what's wrong with this guy? Well, it's when Sidebar did that two-part special on Alex Toth. And that was just a common occurrence. He, if you were a friend of his, at one point, you're going to have a blowout. It happened to Steve Rude constantly. I'd always heard that Steve Rude was pestering him, and Alex Toth basically just lit him up. But Howard Chaykin talks about it. Howard Chaykin said even from when he first started out, he realized Alex Toth is someone you stay away from. And he said, I can't stress to you. He says, this wasn't like a curmudgeonly old man, you know, being that way. He says, he was nasty. But at the same time, Howard Chaykin will talk about his work and completely put that aside, just talk about how brilliant the work is and how he did study his work. But I think it was one of his kids was talking about him, and they said that when people would bring their work to Alex Toth, you know, at conventions, could you critique my portfolio? He didn't want to do it. And he would beg them, please, I really don't like doing this. And they said, you know, some guys, would you please, I need, you know. And as he'd take it out, he'd critique it, but basically he would just slam. He would just sit there and cut them right to the core and basically just destroy these kids. Well, that wasn't his intention, but they said that Alex Toth was always trying to strip things down to the essentials. We all agree with that. His stories, an 8-page story, he had to strip down to just what he needed. And he looked at everything else as just a bunch of trite fill, you know, surface work that wasn't necessary. And but he was that way on himself.
Mm.
And that's how he saw work, and that's why one reason he couldn't get along with people, because all he saw was imperfections everywhere. I don't know. Sometimes he sounded like he was bipolar, but I...
Yeah, probably was, yeah.
But like I said, that was his thought process. That's what made his work so brilliant. But like I said, he was really volatile to everything else.
Well, I mean, there's an article there with Terry Austin.
I haven't gotten to that one yet.
Yeah, it was like Terry Austin, you know, how like for about 10 years he was buddies with Toth and he inked some of his work and they, like, you know, they were all big fans of each other. then he lost touch with them, and then that was it. You know what I mean? Yeah. You know, but I think that happened to a lot of people. You know, it was like,
well, Bruce Timm.
I guess moody is the way you would describe. Yeah, you know?
Bruce Timm was a good friend of his. You know, they did the Batman.
And I think Toth got even moodier when his wife died.
Alex Toth always talked about it. I think it was his third wife, and he said when she died, part of him died with him.
Yeah.
And that's when he really became a recluse. Of course, again, part of the issue was he knew what he was like and what would happen. So he knew it was inevitable that no matter what. Bruce Timm. Alex Toth was a massive fan of Batman, you know, animated series. And he'd write stuff to him and do all these drawings of pinups, bravo, to the crew of Batman Adventure, you know, Batman animated series. He says, he said that's the first time anyone's ever surpassed the Johnny Quest work that they did for animation. And he just couldn't stop going on about how great they were and they made all the right choices. And then they had a falling out when Bruce Timm was doing the Superman animated series.
He didn't like that?
Well, what the argument was he was thinking they were going to do it like the Fleischer cartoons, you know, more like that. And it was on the DVD set, you know, they have commentary, and Bruce Timm was talking. Bruce Timm's kind of like Howard Chaykin, where, you know, if I was doing something, and I was, you know, Alex Toth told me he liked it, and then all of a sudden he turned around and slammed me, I would be hurt. And any time I talk about Alex Toth, I would basically probably start to cry, and I couldn't put it aside. That's the kind of person I would be. But and Bruce Timm said, well, he got upset about it, and then you know, we haven't spoke since, which tends to happen. He seemed like he understood why, but the argument was that he thought Alex Toth felt he should follow along with what the Fleischer Supermans, which were awesome. But then Bruce Timm talked about why they couldn't do it that way. And he said, Superman is really a concept that worked really good in the 30s and 40s that doesn't really apply now, which I hear people say all the time. And he said, he gave reasons why they didn't follow that, even though they thought about it and talked about it in the beginning. And Alex Toth was so upset that they didn't follow the Fleischers that was it.
He wanted it to look like the Fleischer cartoons?
Well, follow more like what they were doing on those Fleischer cartoons.
The storylines or the animation?
I think all of it.
All of it? Because the storylines are basically like Mad Scientist versus Superman or whatever.
I'm going to guess, and I don't know if this is it, but I think a lot of it was that the Superman wasn't a super, you know what I mean? He was more like a really powerful hunk of flesh that was, you know, fighting, but had its, you know, it was more human. Yeah, after a while, they did that in the animated series, but
yeah.
You know, Superman was more like the Superman we knew from the 60s and 70s, where he could just do anything and, you know, godlike. But no, it's Mark Chiarello, you know, was really probably closer than anybody else. And then Mark Chiarello was talking, and he was trying to do a book or a series of books of Alex Toth's DC work. And Alex Toth got really upset at Mark Chiarello that it never came out. Well, he said every time he went to Paul Levitz says, why do we want to publish this? Well, it's, you know, but he couldn't convince him. And Alex would get aggravated and says, what is this? I thought you were some big shot at DC. Why, you're not, you know, and all of a sudden he started taking shots and really, you know, like I said, he stripped things down. He knew exactly where to, you know, cut to the core. And, you know, after that, Mark Chiarello, and they said later people come up and tell him that Alex really regrets, he really misses you. And then Mark Chiarello said he gave him he got a note from Alex. Somebody brought up to him and said, hey, kiddo, I think he wrote him. And then Alex told him, hey, kiddo, how you doing? Like, you know, he was okay. But it happened, I guess it even happened to his kids. You know, he's, yeah. I guess before he died, his kids got back with him, but you know, that's to me, it's like that movie Amadeus about Mozart.
It's the dark side of genius, man.
Yeah. So, you know, whenever you think of Mozart, you think of the founding fathers of the United States and all these things, you just see the good things and how they're all built up. But then you start seeing they're human beings, and some more human and fallible than, you know, a lot of people you know. But when I see him, I just see his work.
Yeah, that's it.
His work was really fun. It was imaginative, and it never stopped. And he was always learning and getting better. And some of those stories, like Daddy and the Pie, to me are some of the greatest. Daddy and the Pie, to me, is my favorite comic short story.
Yeah, it's a great one, man. It's definitely a great one. Yeah, you know, I don't know. To me, it's like, I think you and maybe Kirby got my friend, saying when they first saw Toad, they didn't like it.
Yeah, I was one of them, but I think you said he did, too.
Yeah, he did, too. Yeah.
Well, when I say that at the beginning, even as a kid, I see his stuff in Cartoons Magazine and some of the war books. There was things he did that I liked, but overall, it was too... I wanted it tighter.
Simplistic?
Well, it was kind of... No, I like simplistic stuff, but it was... When I saw it, it was kind of sloppy, like it wasn't as refined. You know, it looked to me, which I do think it was, that he was basically just drawing line to paper. He wasn't doing the underdrawing after a while, maybe.
Hmm.
But as I got older, I started loving that. But that's one thing that bothered me. It just got too stream of thought, I guess, sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, but like I said, but at the same time, I see some of these he did. My God, this is good. It wasn't always the same.
No, his style evolved and stuff like that. But yeah, that was a pretty cool book. I mean, you know.
Well, his Warren work was always tight. It was always good.
Oh, he did some of his best work for that because it was black and white.
Yeah, I think so. But then some of the stuff he did for DC.
There were some great war stories that he did for him.
Yeah, like I said, some of them were incredible. But the one that goes back to me, and I've said this before.
Did you
ever
see the Eclipsos that he did in the 60s? Those are fantastic.
Yeah, those were fantastic. And when I was a kid, I read those, but at the time, that wasn't to my taste. I thought the artwork was good, but the material just didn't, you know, really, you know, I was wanting to read Golden Age Superman stories, or Silver Age Superman stories. But I guess the one thing that I didn't like was, and we talked about it, was a Superman issue that Terry Austin inked. It was an oversized story. It was him and Batman.
They talk about this in here.
But you know, that one had a Gil Kane cover, which I loved, and I was wanting more of that, and I don't know. I didn't find that.
Alex loved it, according to that interview.
Did he really?
Oh, he loved it, yeah.
See, to me, it was kind of...
He was changing his style. Well, you know what? You read the book, and then next time with your show, you talk about it.
I got you.
He was changing his style a bit.
Well, like I said, with Alex Toth, anything I see, I buy. If I get a chance... One time, we were at Colossal Comics. We were going through the 50-cent box, and you pulled out a... As well as DC 100-page... No, it was Batman. It was a Batman story, and the cover was only half there. And he said, here's an Alex Toth Batman. I bought it. It was great.
He did do a story for Mark Chiarella, though, for that Batman black and white book. Or the cover, at least, or something.
Yeah, he did the cover for one. He's done a lot of stuff. And he never... It was kind of after his wife died he stopped. He did a lot of animation work.
Yeah, nasty after that. More so than, you know, whatever. I don't know.
That book, Batman Black and White, that's another one. I can't remember the guy's name. He worked for Hanna-Barbera, and he was a friend of Alex's, and he put that book together. It was Alex Toth by Design.
Yeah.
It was great. It was all the animation sheets and stuff. One thing irritated me, as great as the book was, you know, everything Alex Toth said in it, he lettered himself like a comic book. So everything was printed by Alex. It was his own lettering. But this guy was doing that get down, show enough kind of talking all the time. And I got so sick and tired of it. It was just getting to be too much and over the top, and he wouldn't. You know, at one point he had a portrait Alex Toth drew of him. It goes, it says, the big D. It says, that's me, the D, by the big man himself. You know, and he's just going on. And at one point he says, could this be a Moy by Hoy, could this be? And he just kept going, come, shut up. And he just kept carrying on and carrying on. And then later, I don't know if it was on an audio commentary or a podcast, or if somebody on Facebook talking about it, but they said that Alex Toth was excited about that book. And he said then after it came out, he read it, and he got so fed up, which, again, I did too. The guy just kept going on. He didn't like that flippant kind of carrying on. Well, it was too much. And I'm reading the book, thinking it was the greatest book I ever read, but I'm thinking, dude, just stop. you know, but I guess even Alex had a falling out with him afterwards.
There was this, yeah, now I remember something else too. I think it was, again, we'll go back to Kirby guy telling me something that he had a falling out with Roy Thomas because, you remember how he used to write, like you said, his commentary in handwritten.
Yeah, yeah.
And apparently as the years went on, like the handwriting got a little sloppier or whatever. So one of them, I guess Roy did deem that it was hard to read. So he asked Alex if he could put like a, you know, the text piece in type so people could understand it. Of course, that was it, you know, and I totally pissed him off. And that one to me makes sense, you know, because it's like, well, it's your opinion that it's unreadable, but, you know, let the people decide or whatever. But, yeah, it's...
Well, I understand.
You know what I mean? That's
a little too much. At the same time, it's an editor's job to make sure something's out is readable. If he deems it, he could either send it back to the artist and clean this up. Well, it just happened to me all the time in my job. I mean,
yeah, but, you know, nobody ever touched... Well, I could be wrong on this, but I remember some really late Kirby work. Like, it's either Captain Victory or Silver Streak or Superpowers or whatever. That was... I'm surprised they let him get away with it, but it was Kirby, so...
Well, but
I guess Kirby was as higher in the echelon
well,
of untouchable than Toth. You know? Because that Kirby dialogue, yeah. You know what I mean?
No, I completely agree. And that was bad stuff.
It wasn't bad.
Well, to me, that Silver Star stuff, to me, was... It was third rate. I didn't buy it. I bought one issue and never bought another.
Yeah.
And his Captain Victory stuff was good, but it wasn't as good as the late 70s Marvel work he was doing.
Superpowers.
Yeah, I never bought those.
There's a few other after that, but nobody touched them. Well, of course he can't. It's Kirby.
Well, that's it. And
it's the king.
That's the thing, I guess, is that a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times an editor is supposed to be making the book better. And sometimes they make decisions regardless of what you think.
I want to talk about one more thing. I'm just going to just show you the images. At some point, maybe we'll talk about this. But, man, this guy here, this artist, let's see if I can, okay. Rob Lubbers. Man, this stuff is fantastic.
Where have I seen this before? Lubbers. I've seen him.
I know he did
work. Oh, that's really good.
Look at that. That is fantastic.
Long Sam.
See, this is the kind of stuff that I don't remember ever seeing as a kid, these strips. He did a lot of comic work.
It reminds me of Al Capp.
You worked with Al Capp.
That's why.
See, is it Elliot Kaplan? Al Capp and Bob Lubbers, yeah.
Oh.
He took over, I think he took
Where's
over.
Where does it say that? Oh,
I can give you the files. And I think in some of the early episodes of Long Sam, Frazetta was involved in it, too. This is beautiful stuff.
Yeah, but he must have been one of Al Capp's artists drawing
he was.
Little Abner.
All right. He was, yeah. Look at that.
The women look like...
They look like a Capp women, yeah.
Yeah.
And here's another one that he did. I don't have the color ones, but Robin Malone. I mean, come on. Okay, let's go. That's fantastic work. Again, you know, he did some comics work, a lot of comic groups, but he kind of went into the strips, and this stuff is like...
Yeah, it's really good.
I want to try to find more stuff and read more about it, but, you know, this guy definitely, Bob Lubbers definitely...
It's really good, but, you know, when I was a kid reading the comics in the newspaper, I wouldn't read that.
No, you wouldn't have read it, because it's not like guys fighting or anything like that, but
no,
it's just beautiful
to
look at.
It's beautiful work, but... Like I said, I remember there used to be a comic called Judge Parker.
Yeah, Judge Parker.
And there was another called Rex Morgan, M.D.
Yeah, Rex Morgan, M.D.
Mary Worth and the girls of Apartment 3G. And I remember seeing those, and they were good, but I never read them.
Oh, no, man. But if I would have seen, like, whatchamacallit, Heart of Juliet Jones by Stan Drake.
Yeah.
I think I would have just gone and read that soap opera or whatever, you know what I mean? But yeah, that Long Sam is really good. But it is Cap.
I got you. Well, it reminds me of the Little Abner strip in I'm gonna say maybe the mid-70s.
Well, here,
before he stopped.
Kirby guy sends me these. There's this thing called the My Comics Kingdom Royal, and it's got some of the newspaper strips. Snuffy Smith. Some of them are reprints.
Yeah, what's the top one? Was that Spider-Man?
Yeah, Spider-Man by Alex Saviak.
That's so bizarre, because I was going to say, it looks like Mary Jane and Peter Parker, but it doesn't look like a Spider-Man strip. It looks like Mitchell Connell.
Larry Lieber and Alex Saviak. Larry Lieber,
I think he's writing the strip now.
One of the few, Silver Age guys still around, Stan's brother. Yeah, this is great stuff, man. You know, it's got all the funny stuff, and then it's got, look at that. See, even though it's a soap opera, I would have read Heart of Juliet Jones, because it's so fantastic.
Oh, see, here's the soap opera strips for me. When I was in sixth grade, one kid talked to this.
There's Judge Parker, but it's by.
That's not the artist that I knew when I was a kid.
No.
But no, what was I saying?
There's the old Judge Parker right there.
Yeah, with a slick line.
That guy was great.
Yeah, he
Paul
was
Paul Nichols,
great.
That guy was great. It looks like, what's his face, to Magnus guy.
Russ Manning.
Russ Manning,
yeah. It does look like Russ Manning. No, when I was in sixth grade, this one student was talking to the teacher. It was one of those real cool teachers. And he said, have you been reading 3G? And all he said was, yeah, worms. And he kind of shook his head and said, what's going on? And I tried to read it. That's neat.
The Phantom?
Oh, that's The Phantom? That is neat.
By, who's drawing this damn thing? Mike Manley does a lot of work. Oh.
But like I said, I tried to read after that, just wondering what was happening with the worms. I just couldn't get past it. And there was one time in Mary Worth, there's a Sunday page. And she's walking down the street, and she's carrying groceries, a grocery bag, and she's getting upset, scared. And there's a guy following her, wearing sunglasses. And as she's trying to get away from him at the corner, he comes up and puts his hand on her shoulder, Miss Mary Worth. He was a blind man. He had a white cane. And then she stopped, and that's where it ended. Also, well, what happened next? So I was trying to read it, finding out. And I think the next strip, I was like, well, what happened? And I read it, and I think I got into three panels. Oh, God, I'm mind numb. And I just, you know, those strips just didn't have, even though they were drawn, well, they didn't have what I was interested in reading.
No. So, anyway, on to, we're going to take a break? Should we? Or do you want to start with your stuff?
I guess let's just take a break.
All right, let's go do it.
If that's okay with you.
It is, it's fine with me, perfectly fine.
All right, we'll see you on the other side.
Precious a daisy, precious a daisy. Third Dimension can be found on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
And that was the great Emmett Rhodes with Fresh as a Daisy from his first solo record, Emmett Rhodes,
Never heard of him, but sounded like Paul McCartney.
That's his deal, man. He was a one-man band, dude, where he played like all the instruments on the record. And that was actually a hit. I remember like hearing that like in 1970 and really liking it. I never heard anything else from him, but he put out three solo records that are really good. Then he became like a record business guy. And then he recently, like in the last 5-10 years, he's put out a few more solo things. But he's pretty excellent. We're a California guy.
Yeah. Well, you see, he played everything. Yeah, it's 1970, so he actually played drums and stuff?
He played drums, guitar, bass, piano, just like McCartney did on his first solo record, you know?
You know, McCartney played Band on the Run. He played the drums on that.
Yeah, he did. His band quit on him.
No, they didn't quit. They were going, where'd they go, Nigeria?
It was Nigeria. The three of them went, Paul, Linda, and Denny.
Yeah,
and
but
Lane.
They didn't quit. There was something with their visa.
And, what was there?
The guitar player and the bassist couldn't make it, or the drummer and the bassist.
Okay.
And, it was a guitar player. You know, drummer.
Yeah, Henry McCullough and you can't remember what the drummer was, but I can look it up though.
But it was a visa issue, and so they just went ahead because Jeff Emmerich had the studio, so they just went and they said, "Well, we'll do it." His drums weren't bad.
No, McCartney's a decent drummer.
Yeah,
he drummed on his first solo record too. You know.
Yeah.
Let me see what it says here, but yeah, that's was recorded in Lagos, Nigeria. McCartney wanted to make an album in exotic locale. Shortly before departing for Lagos, however, drummer Denny Sewell, there you go, and guitarist Henry McCullough left the group with no time to recruit replacements. There you go. McCartney went into the studio with his wife and Denny Lane.
I didn't know they quit. I thought that they couldn't make it is what I kept hearing.
That's what he says they left. I think maybe it was about, dinero. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know the whole story, but I'm sure somebody out there does, and they'll let us know.
Yeah.
But anyway, Emmett Rhodes, look for his stuff. It's really good, really good stuff. I was going to pick another somebody else with Don said, now give somebody, more rare.
I was going to play Donnie and Marie.
I was going to play Donnie and Marie doing a cover of Reeling in the Years. And if you guys still want to hear that at some point, write in and let us know, because I've got it, and I love it, okay? And now, back to comic books.
All right, well, Donnie and Marie.
The great Donnie and Marie.
Donnie and Marie was a TV show in the 70s that a lot of people didn't like. But I guess they were around before.
Yeah, the Osmonds.
Yeah, the Osmond brothers.
Now best known for Nutrisystem.
Who?
Marie does commercials for Nutrisystem.
I don't mean to go on a sidebar, but was she a singer before that TV show?
Don't think so.
Because the brothers were famous before Donnie.
Yeah, the Osmond brothers, that was the Osmond sister.
Okay, if you don't know the Osmond brothers, they were, I don't know how they were set up before, but when the Jackson 5 came over doing really well, they put Donnie in the band. He was about Michael Jackson's age.
Yeah.
So they were basically trying to pass them off as the white Jackson 5. And they were on Flip Wilson all the time.
Yeah.
But the brothers were a singing group before Donnie came out.
They were on Andy Williams shows all the time.
Oh, were they?
They were on Andy Williams shows all the time.
And I can't remember the name of that company, but in the early 70s, they did a Michael Jackson or a Jackson 5 cartoon on Saturday morning.
They did an Osmonds one.
And then I think it was the next year they had the Osmonds.
Was it Filmation?
No, it wasn't. It was
Somebody else.
I don't remember who it was.
Oh, again.
But anyway, I never saw. I used to watch the Jackson 5 all the time. I never saw the Osmonds. But and then in the mid 70s, they had a variety show, and it was Donnie and Marie.
Rankin Bass.
Rankin Bass did that.
Rankin Bass.
Yeah.
There you go. Which Kirby worked for later, and Gil Kane. Kirby did Thundar, the Barbarian.
That was Ruby Spears.
Was it Ruby Spears?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which didn't make sense to me because Ruby Spears was the two writers that created Scooby-Doo.
You're right.
Or Hanna-Barbera.
Rankin Bass was like the Hobbit and stuff like that.
Yeah. Rankin Bass did good cartoons too, but they outsourced their stuff to Japan a lot of times. But Ruby Spears was still part of the Hanna-Barbera thing, but it was like an offshoot. It was the two writers. So I thought, well, it's still Warner Communications. I don't know. Anyway. But yeah, Thunder the Barbarian was a good show.
Anyway, Osmonds.
But well, since we're talking about the Osmonds, I wanted to bring up an artist we never talked about, really, but I've been reading his books again, and I love him, and that's Matt Howarth. You're familiar with Matt Howarth. Have you ever read his books?
No, I've never read his book. I've seen his cartoons, I've seen his drawings, and they're interesting.
Man, the book I got here is The Post Brothers Number 9. And I'll tell you, this guy, the first time I had ever seen him was in Heavy Metal Magazine. He was
really?
It was a strip called Changes. And I always read Heavy Metal. I didn't get every issue most of the time. But I'd see it. And at the time, I was stone broke. I was in college, and I'd just see it once in a while, somebody have it. But he drew in black and white, and it really caught me. But it was serialized, so I pick up a story and I try to read it, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. Well, this older guy I knew in Oklahoma City, he always read Heavy Metal, and we were talking about some of the stories in it. And when he got to the Matt Howarth, he goes, "This guy is good. I like him." "Yeah, I like that too." He says, "I can't figure out what he's doing." Well, that was that. I wanted to read it, but it was just kind of sporadic. Well, then, go a few years later, in 1984, Vortex Comics is doing Mr. X. And I think it was the second issue of Mr. X, and the back cover, they had an advertisement for Matt Howarth doing those annoying Post Brothers. Oh, that's the guy! I was so excited. I bought the first issue of the Post Brothers. I thought it was one of the greatest issues I ever read. Basically, it was the Post Brothers and a friend of theirs called Savage Henry. And they could shift realities. They were playing with quantum physics. These guys were all musicians. They had a band. They were anarchists. It was funny. But, when you're a kid in school and you're drawing on notebook paper, and the horizons are the limit. It's just anything you want to draw, you can come up with. That's kind of how I took his work. He would draw these Cthulhu creatures. He'd have things being shot at. He'd have people jumping, flying, shifting realities. And his designs, they were simple. He did his own lettering. But sometimes the lettering got really creative. It was he had a feel for it, how he talked. Sometimes different characters, he changed the lettering. I see people do that on computers typing, but when they change the lettering, it just looks awkward and irritating. When he did it, it was just nice. Even on the cover, when he's saying "disturb the neighbors," it's a different type.
He did like punk rock comics, didn't he?
And it was music is really heavy in here. Sometimes that band, the Replicants, the guys with the eyeballs and the top hats,
the Residents.
They're in it. There are characters in some of them. And he's had a guitarist from Hawkwind, in one series, and some new bands. But he's really heavy into German synth music,
like Tangerine Dream and stuff like that.
Yeah, he loves that. But in some of these, I've never heard of. I know he likes Brian Eno and stuff. He has a character here, I think, called Conrad, which I always thought was Brian Eno. He was a German synth guy. There's a character called Bosch, which. It always seemed like Hunter S. Thompson to me. Yeah, right, that Gonzo writer they talked about. And Doonesbury, it was Duke, Bosch always reminded, but he was a member of the band. They got another woman named Hiroshima, which is a friend of theirs they're with, but she's kind of like, the closest thing you think is the X-Men Phoenix. She's just all powerful and dangerous, and in some of these, that's Hiroshima, the reverse character, but she's destroying the reality she took over. But they have one called the Carolyn clone, and it's a clone of a woman named Carolyn, and it's just clones all over the place, and sometimes there's several of them together. They have the Unseen Girl, which you never see her, but she's always around. And they have, I can't think of that character's name, but he's, let's see if I can find him in here. He's not in this. The Lord Cthulhu, Elder God. But he plays keyboards.
That's from H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah, but he draws him as, you know, like a Lovecraftian creature that smokes a cigar. Usually he wears a suit. But it's kind of funny. He's kind of a pedestrian character in some ways and all-powerful at other times. It's just, they're really fun imaginative comics. And like I said, he's got a really strong design sense to him. And I love how he draws. Like I said, the Post Brothers, he did. The problem was, it's like trying to buy Marvel Comics in the 60s. I found that first issue. Loved it. And then I couldn't find the second issue. And finally, the fourth issue came out, and I got it. Well, where's the other ones? Well, I went to Oklahoma, and the guy, you know, in the store, he knew I loved that book. So when I came home, he said something. I said, you know, I love that. You see, I figured you love the Post Brothers. He says, I like it too. I said, yeah, but I only got the first issue. Now the fourth issue. Where are the other ones? And then one day he told me, he says, hey, come in. I got the second issue of Post Brothers. And he had one, and he got one for me. And he was acting like, no, I don't make a big deal about it, because nobody else could find it. Why was it so hard to find? And my collection was spotty. And then he started doing Savage Henry, which I found out in the late 80s. And he was with Vortex, and later he was with Rip Off Press. They were publishing them. And then, let's see, some of these are Aeon, and AP.
Yeah, some labels I've never heard of. Companies I've never heard of.
When he started doing Fantagraphics, he had a magazine like Love and Rockets called Particle Dreams.
Uh-huh.
And Particle Dreams is like a bunch of short stories. And he was in an interview in Amazing Heroes, and he said Gary Groth came up to him and asked him, he said, why didn't you do this for me when he's doing them for Vortex? And he said, well, I didn't know that you wanted them. So that's when he started doing Particle Dreams. I guess he did three issues of that. And then one of the characters, and well, the only recurring character was a woman named Keith Lama, which is supposed to be Keith Lamar.
Lamar, yeah.
He wrote Retief, and she was basically a kind of his version of a female Retief, although she was much different. She wasn't two-fisted, but the stories are pretty neat. I think it's called Keith Lama Xenotech or something like that. And then they stopped Particle Dreams, and they just did a few issues of just her as a regular-sized black and white comic. But this guy, I tell you, he even in the back of these comic books, he could order his own stuff. He was still self-publishing books. My favorite was one with a young band called the Anti-Chair. He did Temple Snare, This Is Heat. I had a bunch of them that I can no longer find.
Oh, really? You can't find them?
Well, when we moved, I'm guessing they're in my brother's attic, but I don't know. But I wanted to get them again, but I guess those are long out of print and they're expensive. And on his website, you can buy them as PDFs, but I don't want to spend all them. They're, you know, the same as buying a new comic, and I don't want PDFs.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, yeah.
But anyway, I've been trying to fill up holes of all the stuff I got. And like I said, I'm talking about his artwork and his design sense and lettering, but one thing I started realizing, this guy, I like his stories, but he can really write. And one of the characters he got is Connie and Zoo. And before, they weren't in a regular comic. There were no self-published things he did. And one thing he was always proud of, there's no humanoid characters in this strip. And I thought, well, that is interesting. Zoo is like a centipede type character. And Connie is this, it looks like a hornet's nest with three floating orbs around him and tentacles at the bottom. But they have a ship, and they're basically, they do whatever they need to do for money. They're mercenary types. And, but, you know, reading this, that's kind of hard to pull off an idea like that. And the story just keeps you interested. They're trying to figure out how to keep this ship going to get funds coming in. And like I said, I'm reading the story. And again, just as imaginative, the way he uses sparse artwork and stark designs. I had read about Changes that I guess before Heavy Metal got it, he was working with an independent publisher. And it's supposed to be a massive trade, and a massive graphic novel. And then that publisher kind of went kaput before he ever got it out. And the heavy metal started sniffing around. They got wind of it and they wanted to do it. But I think they took it from like a 400 or 500 page graphic novel and shoved it down to like 200 pages.
Wow.
Which would kind of explain why it didn't make any sense. But it was the, I guess, the first story about the Post Brothers. But he did heavy metal. He did a thing called Rab, which is about music reviews. He drew them. It was like a four panel. I loved them. But this one of the Post Brothers in here, it was done in 2004. Yeah, Bugtown, which is where they all live. And I thought, well, this is 2004. I haven't seen him in a million years. I've been ordering these online. I've gotten a stack, so I'm just trying to fill out the massive holes I've got in all these different collections. I got a pile of his, but I don't think I've ever been able to get the next issue of any of these. I've got several, but it's like Swiss cheese. But I've always loved him, and like I said, none of you guys ever read it. And I'm trying to convince Dallas to read some, so I got somebody to talk about with. But you want some fun comics? Look up Matt Howarth. You can't go wrong.
Okay.
Dead silence?
Dead right. Silence.
Your turn.
No, you got more books there.
Well, don't you want to talk about something?
No, let's keep going. Matt Fraction and Fabio Moon.
All right, this is Casanova. We talked about Fabio Moon on the last episode with the two brothers.
That's the two brothers guy, okay.
Yeah. And
Gabriel Ba, okay.
It also has down here another feature in the backup story.
Gabriel Ba is with Michael Chabon.
Yeah, that's the backup story. Oh, he's the guy that wrote
The Escapist.
The Amazing Adventure, yeah, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier Clay, which is a really good book. It's about the escapist. But Fabio Moon and Gabriel Ba are brothers. But I've heard people talk about Casanova on other podcasts. I never touched it. I found this at Wilson's in the dollar box. And I thought, all right, I'll try it. This is, I don't see what issue it is. But all right, I'll pull it out and try it. I guess it's the first issue.
Okay.
But it's fantastic. I love the colors. I love the art style. But the story is really, really good. I was really upset when it finished. I'm going to have to go find the other issues. And the artwork is just right up there with the story. And then the backup story is really neat, too. And I don't think that's really part of it. I think the backup story, the way I take it, is it's supposed to be another series.
Okay.
Which I'm going to look up too, but that one, it surprised me because it's like an entertainment. It turns out it's a female band. And the main character talking about, it looked like she was some type of high art model or something. Turns out she's the bassist of this new band, which is really scary. But I mentioned it to Dallas. He said that he has heard of the strip. But he was interested, but he said, like I just said, I like the colors.
It's very nice.
It's really nice. When I was saying this, it's basically about this one man that doesn't remember anything, but he turns out he's some type of superhuman, like an espionage type agent. And he's working for this old man who's basically got everything. He's rich, and he's basically his manservant. He drives him around. He does this and that. Kind of find out that old man doesn't remember his past either, but they're the same type of person. And somebody comes in and tries to off him, and then they just take him out like they're nothing. And I said, okay, this is, I don't know. I'm wanting to find out more. And the more I read about this, it's like, it leaves me wanting more, and I really have no idea what's happening, you know? And that's both stories. But anyway, Casanova, I've heard people talk all the time.
You're going to have to look around for them.
Yeah, it's just another thing on my list I'm trying to find.
Now, that book I know.
All right.
The originals.
The Iron Wolf.
Iron Wolf.
I've never been able to read these. I've seen him in ads. I like Howard Chaykin. I didn't quite understand because they said he was in Weird Worlds. And but, you know, to me, Weird Worlds was, it said Tarzan Presents, and it was always the Burl stuff. It was, when I read them, it was John Carter Mars and Pellucidar at the Earth's core. And but they said Iron Wolf was in it. Well, come to find out, I guess Weird Worlds was not selling. It would have sold if they were at the store all the time. I only found one issue when I was a kid. But Howard Chaykin did it. It was his character, but somebody else wrote him. I guess he came up with a character.
Is it Len Wein or somebody like that?
Denny O'Neill.
Denny O'Neill, there you go.
It said script by Denny O'Neill. So created, plotted, and drawn by Howard Chaykin. So Howard Chaykin came up with the plots. I'm guessing this is the Howard Chaykin style that you really liked.
I like the Howard. I do like that style. I like the right after that, yeah, when he was doing Cody Starbuck and
yeah.
Maybe Dominic Fortune or whatever.
Yeah, yeah,
take a look at
when
it.
When I say this, I like this. And Howard Chaykin always brings up the
definitely this.
When Michael Kaluta and Bernie Wrightson showed up, they just showed up fully formed. He said he grew up in front of the audience, and I guess he was embarrassed by his early work. Well, when I see this, I see what he would call flaws in it, but I couldn't draw a story like that.
But flaws are fantastic, man. Yeah. You have to learn to love the flaws.
Well, this one, I liked it. The story, to me, the story is a bit spotty, but it's kind of a cross between, which at the time I'd never seen. It's a cross between the future, and they all have these starships, but the starships are made out of wood. And, but it's like an old Errol Flynn type pirate movie, but it's got, you know, space technology. But it's got an empress, and it's taken over everything, and he's basically fighting her tooth and nail. And it was just three issues.
Yeah, it says it right here. It says a new feature began. Originally, it was Burroughs stuff. Issue 8, O'Neill and Howard Chaykin's Iron Wolf. It's ran through issue 10. It says the release of the last issue of Weird Worlds was delayed for several months due to a nationwide paper shortage.
Yeah, well, that was... This must have been 74.
Yeah, I don't even remember that. But yeah, you're right, 74. Yeah, 72, 74.
Well,
yeah.
I can tell you what happened was when OPEC stopped selling oil to the United States, and President Nixon came on and asked everybody to keep their house at 68 degrees in the winter, you know, or
oh, God, I don't
50.
Even remember that.
You lived in Miami, but...
Yeah, right.
In Oklahoma, it's cold in the winter.
Your butt's off, yeah.
If the President of the United States tells you to do something... My dad was going to make sure you followed tooth and nail. And that house was freezing. I mean, it was, and everybody in Oklahoma followed what the president said. I remember one day dad came home really upset because he went by, there was some big hotel like a Marriott. It wasn't a Marriott, but it was something like Hilton or something. And they had these big heater blowers on the parking lot to keep it from freezing. And dad came in and was just giving what for, you know, saying, "The President of the United States has come out and asked us to conserve energy, and they got these heaters to keep the parking lot warm." Well, you know. And, but yeah, I remember that was freezing. And that's when record albums started getting really thin.
Yeah, the RCA vinyl, yeah.
Yeah, because I'd buy records, and they were thick. And all of a sudden they got thin, and you could kind of bend them.
It's called like Dynaflex or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they were flexible.
You know which one I have like that? Hunky Dory, a great record. Yeah. A great record. It's like you could see through it.
But I remember plastic combs were, you know, starting to get more expensive. And
I completely forgot about all that stuff.
Because they were always they were petroleum products. But then all of a sudden everything. I remember... I have an aunt that was always cost conscious. The next thing you know, that's all they ate was chicken because beef got too expensive. And when I went to stay with them, Mom said, "What were they eating?" "Oh, we ate food." Well, all they were eating chicken before was expensive. They'd buy a freezer and keep all this stuff in stock up, you know, and canned goods. And Mom was getting upset because I eat a lot of peanut butter to this day. And Mom was getting upset because all of a sudden peanut butter's going to be in shortage. You got to go buy. You're never trying to get people to hoard. And Mom said, "Well, if it gets too expensive, you're just going to have to eat something else." Okay. But it was a house of cards, you know. Oil got expensive, and then transportation got expensive. Petroleum products got expensive. And So paper was yet one of the others.
Dynaflex was a trademark. See, they started before this, because I remember, because this Hunky Dory was like 72, maybe. Maybe that was the time. Dynaflex was a trademark for a thin, lightweight vinyl LP record introduced by RCA in late 69. Rather than using the stiff plastic material used by conventional vinyl pressings, Dynaflex records used a flexible formulation that allowed RCA to use less material, saving money, and also making the record appear to lie flatter on turntables. At the time, many industry recording plants were using reground vinyl, taking old records. No wonder some of our old records sound like crap. Using taking old records, removing the labels, then melting them, and using the plastic components to make new records. Mm. Such reground vinyl records typically sounded much noisier. Yeah, that's what some of mine do. Than those made from virgin vinyl. Collectors noted that reground records sometimes had small remnants of paper embedded in the outer edge of the LP. Yeah, I think you seem to have a few kinks, maybe, that have.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, so RCA got cheapo, but maybe...
Bunch of losers. But, yeah, but I just remember that. I started noticing that in like 74.
Yeah.
Because before, I hadn't been getting records very long. I just had, a handful.
Yeah.
But they were thick, and all of a sudden, me and my friends would get new records, and they were really thin and
frisbee.
You know.
So anyway, back to
anyway. One thing about Iron Wolf, this was in 74. You know, comics were always black and white. I mean, not they were color, but the character was always black and white. There was good guys and bad guys. This one, Iron Wolf, is absolutely an anti-hero. He's a cool character, but. Some of the women in it, he basically just lets them know that he can't stand the sight of them and get away, and next thing you know, he's sleeping with her. You know, like a James Bond movie. And but all the characters are kind of multicolored. They're not black and white, and sometimes you're not really sure what side they're on. There's vampires in it. Seems like all the aristocrats under the Empress is vampires, which kind of neat. They're not typical Bela Lugosi vampires or anything, but... Pretty wild strip.
It's from the times, man. That was the times we were living in.
Yeah, but like I said, this is so different than other stuff I read. You know, it's pretty unique. I think it's nice that they put this out in one volume. The only time I really ever read Iron Wolf was when Howard Chaykin wrote that trade with Mike Mignola of Iron Wolf. And that's the one I read, where they're talking about the wood and he burned up the forest and the vampire aristocrats and stuff. He went back to it and rewrote it. Mike Mignola drew it. But I like reading the roots. It wasn't bad at all.
And this was only like 3 years before he ruined Star Wars. Right? According to him, anyway. Not me. Doesn't Chaykin say that he ruined Star Wars? Isn't that his main thing or whatever?
Oh, he brings this up every time he talks. And he says, all right, let's hear it. I'm the guy that ruined Star Wars. He always brings this up. You did run Star Wars. I love you, Howard Chaykin. You're one of my favorites. You're one of those sight unseen people. I buy it. I loved American Flag. I loved all the other stuff you've done. But the Star Wars work he did, it was really upsetting me because I wanted to get the comics, and I thought those comics were, they weren't even fifth rate.
Did the Star Wars comic book come out before the movie?
Yeah, long before the movie.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, well before. I think they're starting to do new stories by the time the movie came out.
Yeah, okay.
I bought the third issue because Dave Cockrum drew the cover. And when I first saw it, I was like, God, this is atrocious. But then when I would, they showed a commercial for Star Wars. Oh my God. It just looked incredible. And so I got to check this out. So I think it was the third or fourth issue I bought.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is terrible. And then my brother bought one. And then I was reading that George Lucas handpicked Howard Chaykin to do the book. I was thinking, why did he get George Perez to draw this, you know?
He did Logan's Run, though.
Yeah, quite well. But I'm thinking, you know, George Perez would have been perfect on Star Wars.
Yeah.
But Howard Chaykin, this is terrible. But then I'd see Cody Starbuck. I see My Star is My Destiny. And
Dominic Fortune.
Oh, my God, this stuff is incredible.
Wasn't Dominic Fortune drawn by Howard Chaykin and inked by Terry Austin? I think there was a book like that.
Really?
Yeah, I think there was one.
I'd see those. And I'd see some of that, you know, stuff in heavy metal, like the Cody Starbuck. How is this the same guy that did Star Wars?
Monarch, Star Slayer, there's another one.
But, like I said, I see him in Star Reach magazine, and I think, this stuff is great.
I bought that issue at a convention in 74.
Yeah, but then all of a sudden, I couldn't get to the start, but then I read that, it's that sidebar, again, going back to sidebar, when they talked about Bill Ray, that him and there was, what was the other guy? There's another guy besides Bill Ray that were hired to, Howard Chaykin hired them to assist him on Star Wars. Basically, they drew it, and he didn't give them any of the reference material that Fox sent them. Because I know Walt Simonson did Alien later, and Walt Simonson in an interview saying that he's never worked for any company that wasn't, you know, Fox was just so forthcoming, giving him all the reference material he needs. He said he had stills and schematics and everything, so he drew everything the way it was in the movie. Where did they do that for Howard Chaykin? Well, they did. But
you know, Howard Chaykin didn't even get to see the spaceships. When the story goes that he was invited to watch a rough cut of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And Lucas hadn't done the special effects yet. So he watched the movie, but the special effects were all Lucas did was splice in battle scenes from war movies. Where the spaceships were supposed to be, and that's what he saw. So later on, I guess he got the reference or whatever.
Well, they said they got reference, but he wouldn't pass it on to the guys.
That's ridiculous.
So he said he would draw like for X-wing fighters. He'd just make an X, and these guys were having to make up what they were doing, and they got Dave Stevens to draw the faces. I'm thinking, why didn't he give these guys the reference material? And Howard Chaykin was talking about one time in an interview. He said, well, he didn't think Star Wars, he just thought it was going to be some B space movie nobody would remember. Well, my problem is, it's what we just talked about, Image. You know, that we didn't like the Image comics, but you talk to other people, that's their go-to comics.
Yeah, yeah, golden age for them.
So, regardless, somebody's going to like it. And this is one thing I bring up about a lot of the golden age and silver age artists didn't think comics, they just thought it was a throwaway material. But yeah, you had guys like Carl Barks, you had guys like C.C. Beck, you had Jack the King Kirby.
And Alex Toth.
Alex Toth. These guys are putting forth their best work all the time for my 15 cents. Thank you. I was a kid. It meant the world to me. And I understand these guys thought it was throwaway material, but they didn't treat it. They gave it everything they had. They made me think bigger. They illuminated and warmed my childhood. And so I look at it, you take the assignment, you're getting paid for it, you do your best work. So I don't forgive you for that. And I love you, Howard Chaykin. But, you know, if he said that to my face, I would sit there and tell you, yeah, you did mess up Star Wars. Why? You took the money. Why didn't you do a good job? I don't care if you didn't think he was going to go on. Anyway, listen to me.
Soapbox. Don Soapbox. Well, not Sam Soapbox, but Don Soapbox.
Saying that, Dallas loved the Marvel Star Wars comics that Howard Chaykin did.
There you go.
And a guy I trained with, he just came. He goes to the conventions. He likes comics, but he's the anti-Don. Good guy, but he likes to get, you know, premium issues and to get them slabbed and graded and signed by the creators. And he gets everything signed by Stan Lee that was from Marvel, regardless of, you know, he got Hulk 181, and he got Stan. He's, to me, proud that, you know, Stan Lee had nothing to do with that book, you know, even though his name's plastered all over.
You know what I want to do? I want to get that box of 90s books that they're in great condition that I may be taking to Wilson's and take it to a convention and get them slabbed just to say, bada bing, you know what I mean? You know, just slab the most, like, whatever, and you know, comic book that you can think of, and go, here you go, it's slapped, so now it's something.
Well, like I said, I understand if you got something that's precious, you want to slab it, and if you're wanting to sell it, I guess that's the way to go, but
hey, I've been slabbed.
Yeah, I'm not a... Oh, they slapped some of your books?
One of them that I worked on.
Which one?
Charlton Bullseye number one.
Oh, okay.
My friend Pat sent me a copy, somebody slabbed it. So well, there you go, I'm slabbed.
I'm sure every comic that you have no interest in, somebody slabbed it and it's precious to them. And
that
should be.
But I wouldn't slab it. I just put it in a nice bag.
But like I said, my friend, he's gone and met Howard Chaykin. He loves it. He says, I can't wait to go see Howard Chaykin, which is cool. I really liked Howard Chaykin when I met him in 82. But he was getting the Star Wars books and getting them slabbed. But, you know, he wasn't... I don't even know if he was born when Star Wars came out. So
Dallas?
No, not Dallas. My other friend.
Oh, yeah. Who knows?
Dallas wasn't born when Star Wars came out.
He wasn't born in 77?
He was born in 80. Him and Rook.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's why we you guys make fun of him. I was saying, you know, the Beatles were four guys from Liverpool, England. You know, yeah, they by Pat, back in the early 90s, I was in charge, and I was one of the youngest people there. All these people that were older than me. I had one woman walk up to me and says, "I had my first period before you were born." Well, thanks for letting me know that. But this one guy started working, a young guy, and everybody's talking about their birth dates. And I finally said, "Hey, when were you born?" He was working, didn't even turn around. He goes, "70. And in 93, all of a sudden, all the gears in my head stopped turning. I just couldn't imagine somebody bypassing the 60s. And I'm thinking, he was old enough to work there. I hired him. But
yeah, man.
This one woman walked over and goes, "As in 19? And I thought, "You just 70. And then I just thought, "You bypassed the 60s. Well, Dallas and Rook not only bypassed the 60s, I bypassed the 70s.
And kind of the 80s in a way.
Well, they were growing up in the 80s, which to me, the 60s I remember fondly, but yeah, I'm the same as them with the 80s, but unthinkable. And that's why, even though I always give them a hard time, I'm really shocked at what they know, because they know a lot of stuff that I never would have thought, so.
There you go.
But that's what makes it funny when I say, "Well, the Beatles are four good."
I thought they were at least like late 70s or 80s.
No, I think they were born in 80.
Okay. All right.
So that's why I was telling them, you see, you came in when the world started sucking, but I love the 80s, so.
Yeah, there's some good stuff from the 80s.
Yeah, and the 90s.
The 80s, the early 80s was kind of like the very end of the 70s, so that's cool.
Yeah, but they had their own flavor.
They sure did.
They were their own animal. And then as the 80s went on, like any other time, it started getting really bad.
70s were kind of grim and gritty sometimes.
Except 1974 was awesome, even though there was an oil crisis.
Yeah.
And everything got in shortage, but it's still awesome.
Yeah, but anyway. All right. So we got some more?
We do, but yeah.
Next time.
Yeah, let's save it. All right, anything you want to... I guess there's nothing.
Anything I want to what? You want to live long and prosper?
Well, I always want that. I always want that. So anyway,
that's it.
I guess that's about it. Check us out. As Dallas will tell you in a minute, we got all of our old shows. I'm falling
apart
here.
Yes, and make sure you go to iTunes and leave us a review, because that's going to help us in our ratings and get people to, you know, listen to our shows more and make us popular and, you know, famous and rich and all that good stuff.
I like it better when you say it. That was good.
That was
all right. All right, anyway, just stay on this channel and you'll get another episode in another couple of weeks.
And remember,
read more comics. We'll be right back.
My name is Mao, and with me as always...
Dr. Morbius?
From Parts Unknown.
Question mark?
This is the promo for Slow Robot A-Go-Go, the B through Z grade movie review podcast.
That's right.
If it's obscure and you've never heard of it and it's horrible, we're your men. We're your men. We're here to... We're the dudes that are going to review it and talk about it. And you're going to be like, why would they talk about that? And we don't know either.
And then you're going to want to run out and get these movies and pay big money, Blu-ray money to get these movies because they're all great and you're all going
to
love them.
But anyway, go to bunchofdorks.com.